content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the New York Times and a book called Silver Linings. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we are going to travel back in time, but it's only for a few months. We begin by stepping back to March 24th, 2020. That's the day the New York Times published Reef Larson's story, How to See the World When You're Stuck at Home. As Larson discovered, when you're quarantined or you canceled your trip, you can still go on a journey. The secret? The writer says it's Google Street View. Let's see what he teaches. The other day, anxious in my desk chair, I became a virtual traveler, staring at photos of public spaces, abandoned in the wake of the coronavirus global pandemic. A soccer game in Germany, played in front of thousands of empty seats. The Piazza San Marco in Venice, vacant save for a few confused pigeons. The huge empty courtyard at the great mosque in Mecca, usually filled to the brim with worshippers circumnavigating the Kaaba. These are places built for humans, but there were no humans. It was like peering into what a future might look like after we are gone, a disaster movie without the movie part. Our country is slowly wrapping its head around this disaster in slow motion. It is clear that life cannot go on as normal, at least for the foreseeable future. We are entering a wartime of solitude. Everyone must do their part. A friend canceled a lunch meeting with me a few days ago, writing, I am practicing active social distancing at this time. No offense. None taken. We are all learning a new vocabulary of inoculation, self-quarantine, shedding period, flattening the curve, inflection point. We are learning the exact dimensions of close contact. We are shaking elbows. We are singing happy birthday twice while washing our hands. I can't actually get through the first verse. We are working remotely. We are awkwardly conducting our classes online. We are, for reasons I still don't quite understand, buying ridiculous amounts of toilet paper. By the time you read this, a whole new reality may have set in. And again, this was written in late March. We are also canceling our travel plans in rates not seen since 9/11. Hence the photos of empty places. Our family was supposed to travel to Charleston, South Carolina in mid-March for a short break, but we made the wise decision not to go. Like many American families with young children, we are hunkering down in a voluntary quarantine cocoon with a pantry full of beans, a shelf full of Roald Dahl, the Hungry Hippos board game, and a whole bunch of uncertainty. My wife and I are also attempting to ration our intake of online news around COVID-19 as we're finding the particular cocktail of anecdotes from Italian hospitals, charts of exponential infection rates, and general worry for every older person we know does not do good things for our blood pressure. How does Twitter manage to give you so much and so little at the same time? Needless to say, I have been stress-eating a lot of Cheetos. Also, I was really looking forward to our trip. It's been a long, slushy winter. We were craving the break away from our regularly scheduled programming, away from the tedium of our breakfast routines and Rice Krispies welded to sweatshirts. This is why we travel, to force ourselves to take a breath, to bend space and time, even if just for a moment. We go there so we can come back and appreciate the here. Over the past year, as the climate crisis has consumed my head and most of my writing projects, I've been traveling less and less to there. I've been forced to wrestle with the question of whether flying for pleasure can really be ethically justified anymore. As you can imagine, this is deep existential territory for a travel writer. After much fretting, weighing the culpability of the fossil fuel industry versus that of the individual, I've ended up a tenuous philosophical balance point where I will minimize my air travel, choosing my trips carefully, but I won't categorically say no to all travel. I will try to plan more trips locally, and I will look for alternate ways to find the magic. Such a mindset, it turns out, is also useful in the time of pandemics and self-quarantines. Right after we canceled our trip to South Carolina, Max, my 3-year-old, and I took a break from Hungry Hungry Hippos and attempted to recreate the trip virtually using one of my favorite tools in the world, Google Street View. On my computer screen, we pretended to land at the Charleston airport. I provided the narration. We rented our car, which smelled like Twizzlers and a damp pack of cigarettes. On our way out of the airport, Max spotted this TSA agent dangerously reading and walking by the side of the road. I like to think she was reading Albert Camus. We grabbed some fresh grouper at Crosby's Fish and Shrimp Company to be grilled later. Max threw stones into the water. After a bit of wandering, we stumbled across a crazy dance party on the beach. We gazed at Morris Island Lighthouse from the shores of Rat Island. Then we got sidetracked looking at people's weirdly long walkways to their personal piers, and we wondered how long was too long. Soon Max got bored and left the room, and I hung out with this guy for a while. Though we may have disagreed on more than a few things politically, we bonded on being fathers and the riches-to-rags fate of the Red Sox and our childhood love of the movie Adventures in Babysitting. In short, I was traveling, discovering, maybe not in the flesh, but I was an explorer nonetheless. I've been fascinated with the beguiling world of Google Street View for a decade now. I often turn to it as a research tool when I'm writing a novel, but more often than not, I simply use it to practice being a curious human. What an unbelievable resource, an endless fountain for little details. You can traipse down almost any street in the world, unbothered by snow or rain or gloom of night, completely safe, eating your Cheetos, and if you grow weary of your traipsing, you can teleport to a completely new place on a new continent. What I find particularly seductive about Google Street View is that it purports to be a very objective document of our world. It is simply the product of a car, or a motorbike, or a hiker, driving down a street, taking pictures. But of course, it is far from an objective document. Humans get in the way, as they always do, filling each scene with stories. We dress up in horse costumes. We leave babies unattended in front of Gucci stores. We see the Google car go by while we are mowing the lawn, and we feel compelled to show the world our nipples. That's how we roll. Google Street View also reveals something regular travel cannot, how a place has changed over time. Each time the Google car passes by, a new collective memory is created. The palimpsest grows, like this block in front of what is now the 9/11 Memorial, recorded in 29, 2011, 2014, and 2019. A wound heals in slow motion. Try it with your own block. Street View has an uncanny way of making the familiar unfamiliar. How many times have I gone and viewed my childhood home from various angles, or my old school, or the site of my first kiss, now obliterated into a new shopping mall? There is something tantalizing about being there, but not being there, about being everywhere and nowhere at once. The geospatial distance leaves us wanting, hungry for more. I'm enamored with the glitchiness of these human landscapes, the way people's legs are sometimes separated from their bodies, the way everyone's faces are blurred out as if they no longer exist, and sometimes they no longer do. This is our world, but it is not our world. In 2015, the London-based publisher Visual Editions approached me to make a digital book for their series Editions at Play. The idea was to make a book that could only be read on a smartphone, with coding assistance from Google Creative Lab in Australia. I composed Entrances and Exits, a short story told through Google Street View about a lovesick man who possesses a key that could open any door in the world. The story, like Street View itself, has no end. But I will also be the first to tell you that Google Street View is no replacement for the real thing. Traveling in the real world is about contact, body contact, surface contact, contact with new foods, with new waters, new smells, new light, new languages. Strange that at this moment in time, surrounded by the invisible threat of infection, We're supposed to be denying all contact, to retreat, to barricade our bodies from the world. So then, what do we do? Well, when we cannot travel ourselves, when we cannot lay our hands upon there, how can we virtually recreate that sense of wonder and discovery? Part of the answer, perhaps, lies in the model of the travel writer working with the great toolbox of technology. What we often hunger for is a mind meeting a place, to follow a curious person as she processes a foreign landscape, making discoveries, missteps, leaps of faith. And then, at a certain point, we want to peel off and do our own seeing, make our own missteps, take our own leaps. As Camus once wrote, one recognizes one's course by discovering the paths that stray from it. There are some models out there for such curated, immersive exploration, like the now-defunct Nightwalk, a hauntingly beautiful nocturnal tour of street art in Marseille, or the tragically divine Welcome to Pine Point, an interactive documentary about a mining community in Canada's Northwest Territories that lasted just long enough for its inhabitants to form a world of memories about the place. These are wonderful pieces of online art, but they aren't quite the same as true travel. Recently, with the advent of available virtual reality headsets that don't make you throw up everywhere, there has been an explosion in VR travel apps. Google Earth VR has its own version, while others claim to take you to the Grand Canyon or swim with sharks. Not to diminish the educational value of some of these experiences, but strapping a contraption to your head still seems like a form of retreat, not a form of contact. I still prefer meditative videos of people simply walking through cities. As this field grows, maybe we will see more examples of beautiful curation that still leave us room to wander off the path. In the meantime, maybe the answer is to simply read more books, still the most beautifully curated art form and an activity that is perfectly suited for small group quarantines. I just read C.S. Lewis's The Voyage of the Dawn Treader to my 6-year-old son, Holt. Reading such books aloud and sharing the story contact seems important in a time like this. The Voyage of the Dawn Treader is a bonkers sea expedition in the tradition of the old Norse sagas, following the good ship Dawn Treader as she navigates through magical archipelagos filled with slave traders and dragons and merpeople on her way to the edge of the world. Holt and I had many discussions about whether there was an edge to our own world. It was a journey I will remember more vividly than most of the real trips I've ever taken. But perhaps the obvious solution to finding wonder in this season of staying put is that of some of the best journeys await us right now where we are. Today, Max and I broke our house quarantine and took a walk through the woods. We scoured the forest floor for perfect walking sticks. We marveled at how an earthworm wasn't sad that he didn't have any legs. We pretended we were searching for a mythical bear named Steve. At some point, we startled a cluster of deer into doing pirouettes through the brush. Max froze in admiration of such galloping physics. When our journey was done, we came home and made hot chocolate. The world outside seemed both close and very distant. Max sipped his hot cocoa incredibly slowly, as though he wanted to savor it for weeks to come. Finally, he paused and said, "We went pretty far, didn't we?" "Yes," I said. "Let's do it again tomorrow." Wow. By the way, Reef Larson has authored a lot of novels, I Am Radar and the selected works of T.S. Spivet, which was adapted into the feature film The Young and Prodigious T.S. Spivet. Well, from the March 24, 2020, we're going to fast forward to July 17, 2020. Now, that's when the New York Times published Voices from Travel's Frontlines. We walk in fear, we walk in fear. Writers Emily Palmer and Teruro Imzawa interviewed 6 travel workers from Alaska to the Maldives about returning to their jobs as the pandemic persisted unabated. As the writers learned, the workers found themselves in a new world with restrictions and health measures, uncertainty, and new procedures. Here are their stories. Over the past 6 weeks, countries across the globe have gradually begun to reopen to travelers, both domestic and foreign. And again, keep the time frame in mind, please. This is mid-July 2020. But the travel world, still mired in an unyielding pandemic, is drastically altered. This is especially so for workers in the tourism industry. Their workplaces there are now filled with restrictions and health measures, uncertainty and new procedures. With new corona cases rising in many regions, those just returning to work wonder yet again how long will they be employed and if they are safe. We spoke with 6 travel workers from Alaska to the Maldives on returning to the job. They shared their stories in English and Spanish. Like the workers we interviewed when international borders first closed, they are embarking on a new journey, one of caution and reserve. Among some of them is relief and a renewed sense of hope, while others seek to answer this question: with all the obstacles, how can visitors feel welcome again? And by the way, the interviews were edited and condensed for clarity in our first stop, the Maldives, with Henry Jordan, the executive chef at Lux, North Male Atoll Resort and Villas. We're one of the few resorts in the Maldives that never officially closed. We tried to get other guests from other islands who were displaced. Toward the end, we only had one family staying with us, a Russian family who couldn't get home. We cooked for the 3 guests we had, 2 plus 1 small child. In the end, they Googled some Russian recipes. I think it will be a slow transition. In the last few days, we've had more guest bookings. We're right about 30% capacity for the next week. We weren't even expecting that, so that's a good sign. When people see other people traveling, that's when we'll see it really pick up. The owner of the resort lives on the island, and from the get-go, he made sure that nobody was worried about the future. Whatever was going to come, we would get through it. Nobody lost their job. Now all team members wear masks. The service team wears gloves. We have daily temperature checks, sanitizer in all the restaurants, a 6-foot distance between the tables. Normally you keep the table set as an inviting feel, but now the table has to stay bare, so there's a bit to get used to visually. A lot of the little luxury touches associated with a 5-star hotel, well, we're having to tweak. Our kitchens are well air-conditioned. The New York City basement kitchen doesn't exist here. The hotel has custom-made cloth masks so that it may be better than most disposable masks, and we'll figure it out soon. Then we head to the U.S. Virgin Islands. Jelaine Jones, a bartender at Skinny Legs Bar and Grill on St. John. I didn't expect it to be this busy. I'd say we're doing like 50 to 60%. We allow 50 people in a restaurant at a time, and we've had maximum capacity a couple of times, with people outside waiting to get in. I think tourists are just happy to be here. The employees are more on edge. There are people, mostly tourists, who won't wear their mask and follow the rules. I say, go get your mask, and they get all huffy and leave. We're just trying to make a buck, and if masks will keep us from blowing up, we'd like to make our money while we're open. When we shut down, we were blessed to have only 11 cases across all 3 islands. We've seen spikes in California, spikes in Florida, and people are coming here from those states. Our numbers are rising, and it doesn't make sense. We had the benefit of being away from the mainland. 30 to 40% of our population is elderly, and an island with a majority black population. We have to consider that this virus is affecting us disproportionately. I feel like opening back up is incredibly detrimental to the community, but you know, tourism. It's the way we've become so dependent on tourism, people thinking this is the American paradise and the entitlement of tourists. So now people are starting to say, we've got to fix that. This could wake people up. Our jobs are in the industry that at the same time is killing us. Though the USVI and Skinny Legs reopened to tourists in June, the restaurant is now closed for several weeks after Ms. Jones and other employees learned they had been exposed to the coronavirus. And from there we go to Florida, and Beatrice Menendez, a room attendant at the luxury hotel Fontainebleau, Miami Beach. She's been there for 34 years. I didn't find out we were closing through the company. The news came from my coworkers. It felt like I wasn't important, that they couldn't call and talk to us about it. And then the famous card saying we'd been laid off arrived in the mail 15 days after the hotel closed. They said they'd call us when they reopened, and that was it. I was surprised to hear that they were reopening, and the way I found out about it was through the union reaching out to me. Right now, there's a super low occupancy level, about 11%. Everything has changed. We walk in fear. We work in fear. We don't have the same compassion with each other because it's just scary to be in there. doesn't seem like a hotel. It seems like a hospital. You don't know who has the virus and who doesn't. We are frontline workers who every day interact with guests who may or may not have their mask on. And that's something that's very scary, having that constant contact with so many people. Me going back to work on June 1st was something that I was forced to do. The hotel is not taking into consideration that we could get sick. I'm a person who suffers from respiratory problems. There are already coworkers who have caught COVID-19 after returning to work. During the closure of the hotel, the owners of the Fontainebleau decided to stop paying for worker health insurance. Almost 1,000 staffers, including Ms. Menendez, lost their insurance earlier this month as a result, and that would have been in July 2020. Now to Rome and Manuela Guzzi, a flight attendant for the Italian airline Alitalia. I haven't been at work since March when things got bad with the coronavirus. I'm on standby on Friday for my first flight since then. I don't know where I'll be going or if I'll be going, but I'll definitely be back on a flight to Budapest next week. I'm so nervous and excited. I've been a flight attendant since I was 20. I am 49 now. I've been with Alitalia since 1995 and have never experienced something like this. During lockdown, I was a little worried I wouldn't go back to work this year, but instead I focused on my family and cooking good food. I'm lucky I have my salary, but it's a base. The more I work, the more I earn, and I wasn't looking for 4 months. I live in Rome with my husband and 2 teenage daughters, so you see why I'm eager to go back to work. I'm joking. I miss the people I work with, and I miss the people I meet when I travel. I'm tired of cooking every day. My skin is so nice now from all this rest and being behind a mask, so I'm really ready to start again. I'm not worried about people not following the rules. They don't have a choice but to follow the rules. They have to wear a mask. I'll have to wear the mask for 12 hours. I've been talking to my colleagues, and they, like me, were enjoying all the family time at the beginning and having a moment to relax, but now want to start working again. There are a lot of sleepless nights in this job, and we didn't miss them at the start of lockdown, but now we do. It's a hard job being a flight attendant, but it's like a drug. Now on to St. Lucia and Charlene Mohammed, a front desk manager and entertainer at Bay Gardens Resorts, a collection of family-owned hotels. How do I feel about going back to work? Thrilled, ecstatic, so happy to know I'm going to welcome guests back, but also to know I get to see my coworkers again. We are all excited to get back. It feels good to know that we are reopening, that the island is open, although people are not coming now. But when they do, it's going to be like, oh my gosh, welcome back. In March, things were a bit slow, then everyone had to be sent home, the guest and the staff. It was sad and shocking at once. I've been in the tourism industry for 8 years, and I have never experienced a total shutdown. It hit everybody hard. We've had to learn new protocols. Our managers were working hard on training and sending us all the information we'd need to eventually come back to work and be safe. We had lots of emails and Zoom calls. We did some training on washing hands. Imagine training on how to wash your hands. How to handle food. How to handle takeaway orders. Housekeeping training. How to handle rooms. And so on. The future of travel. Perhaps no industry has been as hard hit by the pandemic as tourism. As restrictions on companies and travelers ease, what will the new world look like? I was thinking about how I am a big hugger. Normally, when I see my returning guests pop up in the lobby, I run to them with open arms. I need to come up with a way to make them feel welcome again. I know we can't touch and there are no more handshakes. The guests can't see our smile, but we have to learn to smile with our eyes and let them see that we still have effective communication with them. They'll know we're smiling under our mask. And our last stop, Alaska, with Kristen Platt, a reservations manager for King of the River Fishing, a tour company in Kenai. I'm the one who picks up the phones and helps people plan their fishing trips with us. I usually spend the winter doing that and the summer making sure everything is ready to go. We have a small team of three, me, my boss Dean, who has been leading these trips for more than 30 years, and Jason, another guide. Things got really quiet in March, which in other years, when the phones are typically ringing the most, with people from all over the world wanting to come here and go on fishing trips. Some people want to go deep sea fishing, others want more remote trips that involve planes. The height of the pandemic was filled with uncertainty and questioning about whether things would reopen and if travel would return this summer. We typically start fishing in mid-May, and Alaska reopened fully on Memorial Day, so that eased some of the worries. Alaska had a 14-day quarantine that really prevented people from coming. That was a good thing, and in the last month, things started picking up again. When the mandatory quarantine period stopped, mandatory COVID testing at the airport started. To come here now, you have to present a negative test at the airport or get a test here. We are not checking any of that stuff. We trust that the people who are coming here are following the rules and being honest. I've been surprised by how many people are willing to take a COVID test just so they can go fishing. One of the biggest changes this year is that everything is happening at the last minute. Instead of calling in the winter to book for the summer, people are calling now and coming in a few weeks. That's made my job a bit crazy, but we're still at 25% capacity. We're excited to be back at work and welcoming people back. To conclude our journey today, we're going to Silver Linings. That's a collection of essays by Our State editor Elizabeth Hudson. In this one, she says, "Shall we gather at the river?" As she reveals, winding creeks and rivers play a role in shaping a Randolph County upbringing. I knew Cable Creek and Back Creek and Caraway Creek, brown water streams, and in some places barely, that running through the woods near my old house in southwestern Randolph County, because that's where my high school boyfriend went crawfishing in the spring when he wasn't hunting deer in the fall. I drove Jackson Creek Road, which bisected the actual Jackson Creek, toward Denton every Friday night for fried flounder from the Little Texas restaurant, holding my breath when I crossed the one-lane arch bridge that passed the dam at Lake Reese, the one that held back the Uwari River, where all these creeks would eventually end up. I knew people who filled backpacks with cans of beer on Saturday nights and hung out in the dark cavern of Pisgah-covered bridge, which straddled a branch of the little river, kissing in the shadows and drinking and telling ghost stories. I won't tell you whether I was one of these people. When the waters of the little river rose 14 feet in 2003, the nearly 100-year-old wooden bridge washed away and became a ghost itself. There's a new bridge now, put up by local townsfolk, who couldn't bear the view without it. I knew about Naomi Wise, the Randolph County Quaker girl who drowned in the deep river in the early 1800s, her story gleaned from the folk ballads we sang in eighth-grade chorus at Farmer School. I wonder, do children in school classrooms still sing these haunting songs, truths made mythic, the ones that tell us stories of our past? One day, I wonder, will we remember the fish camps of the Piedmont that sprang up on our riverbanks? Was your Riverview Inn on the Catawba like my Little Texas on the Uwari? Those places are gone now, their stories swept up in a current of memory that's being carried farther and farther away from us. It all goes by in such a rush. Great little reminder there from Elizabeth Hudson. Well, that's going to wrap up today's journey on Armchair Travel. We hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll join us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I'm reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, the content of our program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments and questions can be directed to 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.